Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the central coast of New South Wales.
Welcome to Coffee with a Coastie. Today I have the pleasure of sitting down with Central Coast local Tanya Green. Tanya is on a mission to help women and couples going through fertility treatments, though has had quite the journey to get there. From being told by medical professionals at the age of 16 that she'll never likely have children, to having children in her 20s, only to find herself undergoing fertility treatments later in life. It is this journey that has fueled her purpose to create the fertility wellness brand Ivy Days, to help others undergoing fertility treatments, and I'm grateful to get the opportunity to sit down and chat with Tanya about this journey and Ivy Days. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you, Luke. Thanks for having me.
That's okay. And very grateful to have you share your journey, as I'm sure many people will be.
Thank you.
To start with, in doing these podcasts, I have no idea who will listen to them, though a big part of why I do them is in hope that a message gets shared that helps someone in some way or in any way. So I'd really like to start by asking if you would mind sharing why medical professionals told you when you were 16 that you would never likely have children, how you dealt with that, and what would you share from that experience that would be a benefit to someone going through that at such a young age? It's a big one.
Yeah, it is a big one. I think when I was going through my journey into womanhood, things just weren't going for me as they were for my girlfriends. And, you know, I probably went, you know, a couple of years of having my period and then going towards my mum and saying things aren't quite, you know, what the other girls are going through, and I was in a lot of pain and heavy cycles and just it just wasn't quite right. And mum is an early childhood nurse, so she's in the healthcare profession, and I'm very thankful that, you know, she took the information I gave her at such a young age, and then we went in and started to get some medical care and try and start finding out why, one, I was in so much pain and why things were a little bit strange for me. And so that started, went off and had some ultrasounds and all the usual things you do for, you know, the pelvic region if some things aren't quite right. And what they discovered through ultrasound was that it looked like I had two uteruses. So there was a duplication there. And this is back in, I think, 96 or 97. So I was about 15, 16 years old. And so then I started and had to go to a gynecologist, which was really unusual at that age and quite fearful, and he didn't believe what the sonographer saw. He felt like you couldn't find that information out with an ultrasound at the time, and I didn't like that particular gynecologist, so we went and saw another one. And I had my first surgery when I was, I think, around 17 or just shy of 17, and that's where they discovered, yeah, I had a duplicated uterus, or a what they call a septum. So it separated the two cavities, and that was explaining why I was having heavy periods, because there's essentially two there. And they also found endometriosis, which is really, really rare, it happens all the time now, but is often undiagnosed for many, many years. So I was really fortunate that they actually found that when I was so young, because that's then helped me as I've gone through my journey, I think. But yeah, at the time, because of what they found, and I don't know if this is just Central Coast doctors or in general, but that it was so rare that they didn't know how my body was going to respond to carrying children, because there was multiple, there was less room, and then they expected that that would result in miscarriage or preterm deliveries or stillbirth. So yeah, I'm being told this at 16, and you know, you're not thinking about having a baby at 16. I'm just trying to be a teenager. And so that, I think by the time I was 18 or 19, I'd already had two or three gynecological procedures. I think I just went with the flow. I don't know if...
Too young.
Yeah, I was too young to probably understand what was happening. And I think if I was to give anybody else some advice on that point, because I was 16 and you're probably not understanding the magnitude of it, is... I was lucky that I had a mum that took action. I was saying that I was in pain as a young teenage girl, and my mum took me to seek medical advice. So I think what I would say to anyone who was listening to this at a young age is to listen to your body and to advocate for yourself, but that can be quite hard as a young teenager also. Yeah, I think that would be the main piece of advice if it was someone happening at a younger age. They do know now that the congenital abnormality that I had, it's occurred while I was growing in my mum's womb. So it happens at that point.
So it was early on. Like it was already born, like as a baby, they would have been able to find it.
Yes, you were born with it. Yeah, so you're born with it. But because it was the late night or, you know, mid to late 90s, there wasn't a lot of information. And now, you know, 25, 26 years on, there's a lot more information. But we know now that that can contribute to infertility. And I have had 3 children subsequently with that. But they were always high-risk pregnancies because they just didn't know how my body was going to respond. And I remember with my firstborn, I always had high-risk pregnancies and was very well cared for by the hospital. And the head obstetrician came in the morning of my cesarean and had a look at me and said, "Oh, I can't believe you've made it here," because they weren't expecting that I would make to a full-term pregnancy. And I've never actually, with having 3 babies, I've never once gone into labor because it's always been very careful, very planned. And the only complication I had with the children was that they were all breech because they didn't have enough room to turn. So
you must really feel the kicking then during that period.
And you kind of, my belly was always round, but you could, whether it was left or right, you know, you could almost tell which side it was on. But I'm very lucky.
And formed in either side? Like
either one, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so I've had lots of surgeries and, yeah, it's very interesting.
How common is that?
I don't know if it's essentially becoming more common now or whether it's the fact that we now have social media that you're hearing about it more.
Yeah.
I do know. I've looked at quite a bit of literature around it in terms of successful pregnancies because it can significantly increase the risk of, you know, preterms and stillborns because there's not enough room from my understanding. I think it was just more when I was my age back in the 90s, it wasn't very common. And I do know when I was giving birth at Gosford Hospital, I don't think they'd seen very many people like me. And even now when I still have to go and have ultrasounds, it's often where people will say they've never seen it before. So I'm not sure exactly how common it is, but there's more information out there now, which I think is really good. But going back to what advice would I give, it would always be to listen to your body, especially if you're having pain. If you're having pain at such a young age or any stage during your cycles, you need to, you know, advocate for yourself and go and get some support and medical advice.
Now you just shared, and as we mentioned, that you did, against the odds, end up having children in your 20s in a previous marriage. They're now in their teens and older, and that ended up being not until later in life that you were faced with the challenge of infertility. How has this dual experience shaped your perspective on children and infertility?
So I think for me, my infertility was a known infertility. So in terms of, I actively took part in essentially becoming infertile because with my third baby, who was born when I was 25, because I had the complex gynae history and lots of surgeries, we assumed at the time that it wouldn't be safe for me to get pregnant again. So I decided to have my tubes tied at that age. So I knew that I was making myself infertile at that time. But I also, one of the questions they did ask me in that was, "You're 25, you know, what happens if you want to go off and have another baby down the track?" And I said, "Well, have a look at my medical history and how many surgeries I've already had. 3 babies, all cesareans. It's not really recommended that you go off and have a 4th. And I said, "So the best way for me is to tie my tube. So let's go ahead and do that." But I think what I've realized now, subsequently getting remarried and wanting to have another baby with my now husband, I still thought coming into my mid-30s that despite having my tubes tied, my eggs would be okay and everything would still work well. But what I've realized is that I'm probably more grateful for my children, because I think if I had have waited, even with my tubes, what I've identified is that I probably would never have been able to have a baby anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes me more appreciative of what I actually do have.
Yeah.
And then what I'm realizing in going down this journey and creating the new business and doing a lot more research and being in the space a lot more is that we need to protect our fertility. Like our bodies are designed to have babies in our 20s. Well, you know, early 30s, but really in our 20s, from my opinion,
yep.
I'm not a doctor, but your bodies are, that's when they're supposed to do it. And I think looking back now, going through those dual experiences of being a young mum or essentially a teenage mum, and then trying to get pregnant in my late 30s, early 40s, is that I've just realised that fertility aspect is so important. And we go off and we can live our lives or we wait for everything to be lined up. Do we have the house? Mm. Have we had other experiences? Do we have a good job? And we want things to be lined up so that, I suppose, essentially we can support a family better. But the fertility doesn't wait, especially for females. It's not waiting for all of those things to happen. And being in this space now around supporting people in their fertility wellness, it's really prevalent. And we're delaying having children for, you know, lots of reasons, which are quite okay, but you're taking a risk in that.
Yeah.
And I realize how special your fertility is.
Yeah.
If you think you, at some stage in your life, want to start a family, but you're not ready, I really think in your 20s, late 20s, start researching and having a look at it. And also just the fact that, you know, womb wellness is important as well. Mm. So there's so much happening silently inside a woman that we don't know about. And then you go and try and have a baby and then it starts unraveling some of it. And I just think protecting your fertility is just so important. And I think that's an area that's not often discussed, but infertility is becoming so prevalent now through lifestyle choices and age and a whole, you know, environmental factors and so many different things. But yeah, I think protecting your fertility is the key thing.
That is interesting. Like, as I've already shared with you, like my wife and I have had kids much later on in life. Yeah.
It's,
so I very much relate to what you mentioned about wanting to feel like you're more secure, wanting to feel like you can provide and anything and all this sort of stuff. Where in my 20s, like, not that my wife and I were together in my 20s, we met when I was in my late 20s, but it just took a long time. You know, we're like, oh, no, we need to go on the holiday first. So you need it. So, yeah, I can very much relate to the person out there.
Yeah.
And I know my wife can too, like, because, yeah, she's where, you know, didn't have her first kids until her late 30s or mid 30s or whatever, or late 30s for me, mid 30s for my wife.
And infertility, certainly.
Trying to get all those boxes
ticked,
you know, before you go and have kids.
And I can wholeheartedly say, being a young mum, that it's not easy because you're not really financially positioned. I was 20 when I had my first child. But you make it work. No matter what really is happening, you make it work. And I hear lots of people saying, oh, it's not the right time, or we're waiting for things to happen first. And that's completely up to the individual to do that. I really appreciate that. But watching women go through what they're going through now as a direct correlation of decisions made is hard to watch.
Mm.
But you also appreciate everyone has to go and live their own life the way they want to live it. But it's something you can't get back. It's not an infinite resource.
Yeah.
And I wish there was more discussion around that, especially for women, because it's an aging process. Our eggs will stop at some point. And I really thought that even though I didn't have my tubes, I had my eggs, and that's fine, and we'll be all hunky-dory and off we go. And that wasn't the case at all. And it was a really big realization to have.
Do you mind if I ask, like, obviously, yes, there is that thing, I've just got my eggs. So what is it that causes infertility when you think
Well, infertility can be for so many reasons. So there's, not being a medical professional, but, you know, there's unexplained infertility.
Well, I suppose in your circumstance, then, if you can only speak of your own.
Yes. So mine was really around, you know, not having my tubes, my eggs can't get to where they need to on their own. So you need the medical intervention. So we always knew when I started dating my husband Jordan, one of the first things I think on our first few dates were, because I never thought when I separated from my marriage, it wasn't really a thing that I ever thought about, because I thought I'll be a stepmom maybe at some point. Didn't ever think about wanting any more children. And then Jordan came into my life and all of a sudden that was on the cards. But one of our first few conversations within our first few dates was, if you want children, then we're best to probably not pursue this, because I can't have any. I don't think I can have children. Mm. And, you know, he knew that about me. And when he proposed, one of my first thing out of my mouth was, are you sure? And he was a little bit insulted, and he still says it to today, that's what I said. But what I was actually asking him wasn't, is he sure about asking me to become his wife? Because I knew in me saying yes, he would actually potentially be giving up a piece of him in terms of not being able to have a baby with me. So it was actually me asking him, is he sure? Mm. Because I won't be able to give him a child. And, you know, even sometimes today I feel like he made that decision prematurely, because a lot of his friends, well, all of his friends at the time had no children, and he was becoming a stepdad to my children, but no one had any. So he wasn't around people that were raising kids. And now, years and years later, people are on their second and third and fourth children, and we're watching all of that unfold. And I feel like sometimes, and it's kind of a sore spot in our relationship on occasions, more from my perspective, that he gave away something he didn't know that he was giving that away yet, because it wasn't around him.
You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. And so that's a hard point for us, where I have a guilt for, well, if he wasn't with me, he would potentially be able to have a baby. And that's something that I've kind of pushed on him every now and again when, you know, we're in the trenches of trauma or being triggered or being feeling hurt or sad about our situation. I think, oh, if you only picked somebody else, you have a chance and you're still young enough, you know, do we want to continue on this path together? And he will always come back to me and say, like, I picked you, you know, I knew what I was doing. And, you know, he's my rock. He's my person. But we make these decisions in our life and we just don't know what's going to happen with it. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That's
a bit full on.
No, it's also very, it's, everybody goes through these, well, not that particularly, but, you know, challenging times in a relationship. So, to hear you speak of it, it's
like the crossroad, like, you know, do you turn left or do you turn right? And both paths are unknown, you know. We tried, right, you know, and it just didn't work for us.
In the back of your
head
you think, no, we'll work something out. It'll be, you know. My next question is pretty obviously in how open and willingness, like your willingness to share your journey in sort of what motivated you. So you've got a blog called The Naked Wife that you shared your journey throughout your fertility treatment. You're obviously willing to share, but what motivated you to create a blog and go out there and share that?
Yeah, well, I think the blog in itself has probably only been live for maybe a year or 18 months. I created it, but I'd never published it.
Yeah.
It was like my place to go for therapy. And so I would either journal in a book or I would type into this website that I had always thought I will share my journey, because a lot of people do share their fertility treatments or what's going on in their life through social media. And I wasn't really up to doing that, I don't feel like I was good enough at social media to do it. So I just started journaling and writing, and that was the place that I did it. But it took me a long time to publish it. And to be honest, I don't know if anyone sees it or reads it. Yeah. But the motivation behind it was really for me in a therapeutic way to get my thoughts out onto paper. And I just did it in that style because that's how I had always thought that I would let it go out into the world in the hope that it would help people. Yeah. I was hopeful when I started it that I would end up having my happy ending and be able to share all those step, you know, tips and steps that I took to get to there. But, you know, that hasn't happened. So it's kind of gone the other way. But really it was all around therapy. But I also believe that people's stories have power. Whenever I'm browsing on social media, sometimes now that I'm starting the business, I'm starting to really watch and analyze how I'm interacting with social media and what made me stop on that post to read it or listen to it or watch the whole thing through. And it's because it does make you feel like you're being heard or that somebody else is going through it. And you think, yeah, I resonate with that, whatever that person is showing. And I thought if I could be that for somebody else, and even if it was only one person, then that's worth it. And you don't know that it's for another person or that they're getting something out of it unless they write back into you. But that's really where it was. It was just a place for me to park my thoughts. But I was very scared to publish it because there's all the, well, I suppose your fear and your ego steps in and it's like, well, what if my family read it or, you know, other people, you know, read, how are people going to interpret it? And they're some of my private, but not so private because I'm publishing it thoughts, but they're my deep thoughts. Like when I'm writing it, it's coming from a place of that rawness in the moment. Sometimes I'm writing it retrospectively. So it might be 6 months later and then I have a bit more of a thought about it and then I put it in there, but it's always coming back to helping myself first, because I can get the information like out of my head and onto paper, which helps me. And then if I was brave enough to make it go live, which I did do, and someone else reads it, then it may help them. And because my story is very unique, as is everybody's, but I do have a bit of a unique twist on pregnancy and between the two spectrums of being a young mum with the condition that I have, but then also being infertile and going through IVF, if anyone can pick something up from that, then that's worth it to me. So that's why I leave it there. I do sometimes think about taking it down, like I get scared with it being there, but I also think, no, I'm proud of my words. I'm proud of my life. I'm proud of my story and my history, and I'll just put it out there and see.
So I can only imagine that moment then you went from private wherever it was to public, and how was sleep that night like?
I mean sometimes I even forget that it's there because I don't write to it often. I just kind of dabble, and there's probably a lot more drafts that I have that I haven't quite refined yet that haven't been published. But I always, what I really appreciate about it for my own self is sometimes I go back and read it for myself and I think, wow, look how far I've come, or I actually don't remember that I had that thought or that I was feeling that way. And then I can see how much I've grown as a person, or the things that I was feeling 2 or 3 years ago to now how I would feel about the same situation. So it's almost allowing me to learn about my own behaviors and improve those, or just be proud of what I've accomplished and what I've achieved. And I think it's a more permanent fixture than, say, you know, social media, where it's a reel or one post and I can write so much more rather than just, you know, one or two sentences. I really want to do a full brain dump and then put it there. And like I said, some are still in draft form and I haven't put them out, but I was very scared to post it. I don't think I've had anyone come back to me and say they've really read it though. So I don't. Hopefully. Thank you.
even Jordan's post, you put Jordan's post up there, and about the male perspective of the process as well.
And he wrote that male perspective piece while I was undergoing an egg collection. So I was in Brisbane. I was fast asleep having my procedure done, and he was sitting downstairs waiting for me, and he wrote that while he waited. So that was really raw for him as well, because it was all happening in the minute. I would actually really like him to do that a little bit more, I think, because he's got away with words for himself as well. And I truly believe writing is therapeutic, whether no one sees it, whether you write it down and burn it, whatever you want to do. I really do think, especially when you're going through grief and trauma and fertility or anything that you need to try and work through, I really feel that writing has a lot of power.
Mm.
So that's something that I would encourage for people going through fertility treatments, even if no one sees it, it's no one else's business. But if you want to put it out to the world, put it out to the world. But yeah, it's therapy for me. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you even, it was an article you wrote about this, is therapy for me.
Yes.
Yep. You speak of trauma and its long-lasting effects on your blog, The Naked Wife. Can you share any coping strategies or advice that those currently in the midst of their fertility struggles?
Yeah, I think I speak of the fact that trauma is long-lasting because I don't think there's a life cycle on grief. And I think the fertility process, whether you're successful or not, leaves an imprint. And I don't think you can go through this type of experience and walk away unscathed. And there's triggers everywhere. So from being some, it's interesting for me because I'm triggered by the fact that I wasn't successful having a baby with my husband who then will not get the opportunity to have a baby. So I watch and observe him, and then I've got trauma around not having those experiences with him. But then I already have three children. I'm very lucky and grateful for that as well. But it's a trauma attached to the now with Jordan and not being able to have a baby. And then you see things everywhere. The mum's walking down the street with the baby, and then there's Father's Day and Mother's Day and, you know, the dad playing soccer with his kid, and it is everywhere. And I find that it's work quite often. It's work all the time to try and move through it. Some days are easier than others, and I think because even though we're a couple of years out of the fertility treatment now, I still always go back to, did I make the right decision? Could I have tried harder? Should I have made a different decision? And you're surrounded by kids everywhere. And I think in terms of strategies, you know, you can probably hear I'm trying to work through my own strategies. But for me, my strategy is I do my writing. So that's one of them. I think another one is creating Ivy days, because there's an experience there that I can now shift and shape into a more positive experience. And perhaps sometimes I look at it and think, well, the universe wasn't aligned to give us a baby, but maybe it was aligning to do this instead. So I just try and reframe why it didn't work for us. But I think for me, one of the other aspects around just circling back to something that triggers me is that I've created this business, which I'm really proud of, and I'm proud of the purpose. But what was unusual that I'm finding that I wasn't expecting is that we've stepped out of fertility treatments, but yet I've reinserted myself back into the space of infertility and people undergoing fertility treatments. And for the people who have purchased my products, the majority of them, I've opened up conversations with them. So I'm aware of where they're up to in their cycles and what's happening for them, and whether they're being successful or it's on hold or they've had losses. And what I wasn't expecting was to be really pulled into that and have so much emotion and feeling for those couples and for the people going through it. It's like I'm being pulled back in every time. And so then I'm trying to figure out my way of, oh, how do I navigate this? Because I've got my own trauma attached with it. But I want to help other people, and I think I've got something of value to help them through their cycles. But yet I'm also going through the motion of learning how to
live.
Yes, exactly. And I want so desperately for every person that I'm involved with to have a good outcome. And I also know, you know, the women, I sent her one of the on-the-go pouches last week to someone urgently because she was on her second day of her cycle. And for people going through fertility treatments, usually day three or day four is when you'll start injections. So I express posted it to her. But I also know that on each day of what's happening, what potentially they might be feeling like. And it's like I'm being pulled into that, and I've got multiple women going through different cycles at different times, and you just want the best for them. And I didn't recognize that I would have that feeling and experience. So I think I have to do some counseling work around that to try and slight, you know, detach, because I honestly just want the absolute best outcome for everybody. It's probably unrealistic, but I find myself really ingrained in everybody's, you know, experiences of it, and I need to try and figure out a way to somewhat detach from it. I think there's going to be some strengths in that, where then I can offer a really good level of support separate from just a stock standard consumable. And it's this business is very heart-centered and purposeful for me.
Yeah.
But then there's going to have to be a distinction between this is the business that I'm running and this is my purpose, versus the emotional toll that it's going to take to keep going. And that's something I wasn't expecting when I decided to start the business.
Wow.
I don't know if I actually answered your question.
You did. After six attempts at IVF, you decided to end fertility treatments. You've written about the wrestle with that and how you still wrestle with that to this day on your blog. I think I've shared that I have children, someone very close to me doesn't. And it's maybe we've had this conversation offline. Like, you know, I don't even know how to approach that conversation to say, oh, how are you going or whatever that is. And so to think of like where you'd be at and what, how to make that decision of, oh, we're going to end this, and that must, and you write about it, you say it still weighs today, and you touched on it a bit before, like, did you do the right thing, you know, even whilst going through it, are we, you know, could I have done something differently at that point or whatever that may have been? So to make a decision to stop, I can imagine is probably the hardest decision in the world. Do you mind sharing some of like making that decision? Purely up to you though.
Yeah.
Because it's a very deep conversation.
It is. It was very, very hard. And I will say quite transparently that the decision was, I made it for us as a couple, rightly or wrongly. I think I wrestled with it. Was soon after our sixth failed cycle, and we'd had an embryo transfer that time. So you know, the expectations are, you still just, you hope so with everything in your fiber, you just hope that it's going to work, and you wait, and every day that goes by, it is, you know, you hear it all the time. People say it's a roller coaster, and it just really is. And the emotions can shift and change in the matter of minutes.
I'm assuming that you're injecting yourself with like some sort of something that's changing your emotions and changing your...
Well, I think there is that in terms of the response that people might have to the medications, and that can be very, very different. For me personally, I felt like I handled... I don't feel like my mood as such changed too much through the injections.
Mm.
I think it's more the emotional component of it, where you have highs and lows, and you're going through all your monitoring appointments and your blood work, and you wait with bated breath as to what the doctor or the nurse is going to ring with. And then, you know, if you get lucky enough to have an embryo transfer, there's what's known as the 2-week wait between the time the embryo is placed back into the uterus to then when you can have a blood test or a pregnancy test to see whether the baby's stuck or not. And there's nothing really, you can't do anything in that week in terms of, you can't change the outcome. Your body is going to do what it's going to do. There's nothing you can do. And waiting for all those different variables to take place when you have, it's a process where you really have minimal control. You know, you can control what you're eating, whether you're exercising, all these elements. This is a really uncontrollable aspect of your life. And we got to the stage where, you know, we had six goes at it. We could have probably kept going, but what I had to look at for me was the fact that I was a couple of weeks away from turning 40. And based on my results and six cycles, and I had very high dose cycles with very limited results, we didn't get many eggs out of all six cycles, and the writing was on the wall. You know, the doctors were saying, look, your best chance is an egg donor. And whilst I did go down a path of investigating that, which is a whole other add-on as well, I had to recognize in myself there were various elements for me, because I wasn't yearning to become a mother, because I am one. I have been lucky enough to have three children. what I was yearning for in this whole process was to have this experience and have a child with my husband who doesn't have a child, to be able to do that together as a couple. And for me, looking at an egg donor, it was an option that I explored, but when I sat with my feelings, I had to pause and think, I've already been a parent, an active parent, since I was 20. I was approaching 40. And an egg donor doesn't just happen overnight. There's a whole process. Possibly have to go overseas, or you need to develop relationships here in Australia where it's altruistic, so you can't pay anyone for an egg. You have to, it's not simple. It's a big process in itself. And so then in considering that, I thought, well, there's a good few more years. And then what am I, 42, 43, 44? We don't even know if an egg donor would work for me, because I've had so many surgeries. I don't know if my uterus is capable. What if we go through all of this and it still doesn't work? But most importantly, I had to sit down and think, I would be maybe in my mid-40s, already parent since I was 20. If we got successful, then I have to actively parent for another 20 years, and there's 40, 45 years of my whole life. When I say active parent, I've got children that I'm responsible for, that I care for before they leave the home. And that to me was just too far. Like, I had to realize my own limitations, and that was one of them. And then with the egg donor option, I had to realize that because I am a mum and I have had children, I realized that, well, it was important for me, for any baby had a genetic connection to my three children. That was one important area for me. But I realized that if I went down the egg donor path, however long it took, I would actually only be doing that for my husband and not for myself. And then therefore, if I was thinking that way, that's not beneficial to the human being that's being created. Because I think there's another whole aspect of, there's always a baby involved here that, you know, will be here. And I didn't think that was fair if I wasn't going into it wholeheartedly. So I recognized that as a limitation for me. And so, you know, I got the courage, and my husband and I sat down, and I had to lead that conversation, because I feel like we would have kept going if I had have said yes. But I couldn't. I had to realize where I needed to stop, and that was it. But in that stopping and making that decision, it meant that if he was with me and we would be life partners, you know, for the rest of our lives, he would not have his own child. And that's where my decision is hard still to this day, because I made that decision for me, but I also made that decision for us as a couple, and he really didn't have a choice in that, because I had to say, no, I'm not prepared to put my body through this anymore, and no, I'm not prepared to explore any other options at that time. So that burden still weighs quite heavily on me, where I feel like I took that away. And I'm pretty safely assuming that I think many women or men, when there's one person that's potentially the infertile out of the couple and the other person is fertile, and you're trying to do it as a couple, it's really hard, because you wanted something so desperately together, and then you have to recognize kind of the writing on the wall and the science, and it wasn't working for us. But there's always the what if. What if I had have done this? What if I continued? Should I have tried one more time? And that's the work I still have to work through, I think. Because I don't think it ever leaves you. I don't think it will ever leave me.
It does take me back, though, the first thing that comes to my mind from, like, the, you know, like the amount of, I can see the amount of pressure you put on yourself, though. You did ask him at the beginning, are you sure? I don't know if we actually spoke about that before we were having this conversation recorded, no, or after or during, but so I can't even begin to imagine the journey, to be honest. But yeah, it is, I think with any, you talk about age, so I'm 46 and I've said, you know, I've got an 8-week old, and I think oh, I'm gonna be 60, I'm gonna be 14, like 60. I remember when I was younger looking at people that are 60, they were old. You know what I mean? and now I'm gonna be 60 with a 14-year-old. It definitely makes you, or for me, just makes me compassionate towards anybody's journey because they're all different, right? We're all very different, experiencing very different things, all asking what if, you know, of everything that we go through.
Yeah, and I think that that is the compassion that comes when you go through hardship, whatever that might be. It does open yourself up to see things from different perspectives when you actually go through it. And it is something that infertility treatments, it is genuinely something that you could say, unless you have been through it, you can't really recognize it, because you can be there on the outsides or the outskirts of someone that you love and adore and support them. But until you're right in the thick of it, it's very hard to explain. And it is something that I think that's why I'm uniquely placed in a way to create this business, because of that. But also I feel like a bit of an imposter as well, because I have had children. So it's like, well, how do you separate those two? But it doesn't need to be separated, because it is my story. And I can bring all that experience into this. And I suppose it's whatever I do, I bring all that experience into it. But, yeah, you create, compassion around many different aspects when you experience things in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, as you say, that's exactly right. And that sort of brings me to my next question. So as painful, no doubt, as your IVF journey was, going through your blog once again, I read the line that you wrote, I could not be more thankful for the challenges thrown my way. Why? Because my mess is becoming my message. This message, no doubt, as you've already mentioned, is Ivy Days and your mission to now help other women go through IVF. Can you recall the exact moment that made you think, I need to create something to help other women go through this and that form into Ivy Days as it is today?
Yeah, I think the first thinking of Ivy Days came about when, for my very first cycle, we did it here locally and I hid away from the world and I hid away from Jordan as well. He didn't see me do any of my injections. I closed the door. I didn't let him in, and that's probably one of my regrets. Biggest regrets around that is, I mean, I was so unsure. I've not given myself an injection before. We just were so naive and didn't know, and you don't know what you don't know, so that's understandable. But I hid away, and then that very first cycle, we only got a few eggs and none of them fertilized. So we thought, oh, we just have to get to day 5 embryo status, and not thinking that we wouldn't even get to day 1. And so the next cycle we had, I wanted to do something differently, because I knew I didn't really care for myself the way I should have. I knew I let my mental health slide. I hid away. I didn't let him be involved. That was hard for him, that I didn't recognize at the time. But we also, I wasn't happy with the local clinic here, and I actually ended up Googling my condition, because a lot of the doctors here actually didn't support me trying to have a baby because of my condition and all the gynae surgeries I've had. And I ended up finding a doctor in Brisbane who specializes in the type of uterus I have. So I basically cold called him, which, being in the hospital environment in a previous working career, was like, you know, you don't do that. You don't direct call or direct email a doctor. But I did. I emailed him directly and gave him a brief rundown of my condition. And I asked him if we were really willing to travel from New South Wales to Brisbane, would he become my doctor? And he said yes. And so we traveled up and had exploratory surgery with him. Well, I had exploratory surgery, and he gave me the all clear with all the testing to pursue IVF, and he felt that it was safe for me. So he became our doctor. And so then really this is where Ivy Days has come from, because we were traveling doing IVF. And what I realized is that I was picking up all my medications, and I was like, I've got to get on a plane with these. How do I take all my meds on a plane? And then I started searching for things that would allow me to take my meds with me, and nothing existed. And I was asking the pharmacist, what size cooler bag do I need to transport my meds on a plane? Can I even get on a plane with meds? So we traveled up to Brisbane, and I think I put it in a 30 can Coca-Cola cooler bag with ice packs packed in it and then off I went, and I was like, there's nothing here to support women who need to take these medications with them. Granted, I was traveling interstate, not everybody has to do that.
Yeah.
But I started just exploring what was available and realized there was really nothing, and just parked that decision, like that idea, for a moment, because I hadn't yet fully gone through that cycle too. But the moment really Ivy Days did come into clear focus was it was January. We went to watch a cricket game at the Gabba, and it was a really hot summer's day, and I took an oversized bag with a huge sharps container and an ice pack and all my medications, and I think I had to do 3 injections that evening. And going through security where they're checking all your bags, and I think, I've got needles galore, a sharps container, are they even going to let me in? And the male security guy said, very quietly said to him, oh, look, I'm going through IVF. I need to do some needles in here tonight. You know, here's all my medication.
Mm.
He called over a female security guard and said, can you speak with her? She gave me a wink and said, go on through, and said, good luck. And it was that injection in the filthy female toilets. Well, all the activities were going on, and here I was trying to set up my little station to set up 3 injections where there was nowhere to hang my bag. You know, it was just really challenging situation, and then that became very overwhelming because it was hot, it was sweaty, it was loud, it was dirty. You have to, you know, disinfect the vials, and you disinfect your belly, and you know, you really want a better environment to be doing it with. But what was critical for me during IVF, because I locked myself away first cycle and didn't care for my mental health, when we went to Brisbane, we almost made a holiday out of it. Mm. Let's enjoy ourselves. Let's try. And this is a really challenging time, so let's look at the good of this situation. And so we went out to dinners and we did over-the-top golf and went and watched the cricket game. But that all meant that all my meds had to come with me everywhere I went. And that's the day really the pouch came into my mind, because I thought, there has to be a better way for women to have a life during IVF, because you don't have to lock yourself away. You should be able to go out and experience the joyful moments, because it's in the joy that we, you know, potentially become less stressed, and then that can have positive benefits on our body and our hormones. And so it just really was like, there's nothing on the market. And then throughout all my cycles, those type of activities continues, not necessarily getting out and about, but just the requirement to inject in different places. It might have been in the car, on the side of the road, because when the alarm bell rings that you need to do your injection, because it's very timed, wherever you are, you need to do them. So you need to take your meds with you, and you need to make sure that some of them need to be kept cool. And there was nothing on the market, I learned going through the different cycles when I started doing more research. So that's when it really came into focus for me. But that was January of 2020. Yeah. So a few years ago.
You certainly changed the environment from the first time around to the second time.
I did.
Around.
Yes. Well, the rest of our cycles, bar one, was in Brisbane. So we traveled.
You stayed with that same doctor in Brisbane.
Yes, and we relocated ourselves for the duration. So we would go up for 2 to 4 weeks each time and get an Airbnb apartment and just stay up there and be close to the doctor. I did actually travel in May of 2020 when the first COVID wave came.
Mm.
That was really interesting because I was quite literally in Brisbane Airport, the only person other than security in Brisbane Airport for about 4 or 5 hours, because there were no flights. You weren't allowed really to travel. And I had the permission granted to go into the state, but it was also new. I've got video footage of me walking around Brisbane Airport with the speakers going, and no one was there but me, just me.
Mm.
And that was really interesting.
Can only think, like, so we went into lockdown and we all got locked up and we all got stuck with our thoughts, and we all, you know, like, there wasn't, you weren't able to get out, and you've just finished something like this after 6 attempts and you're locked down and you're inside.
Mm.
That must have been quite on top of everything else. You've actually got time, you're stuck, or did you get busy during COVID, at the beginning of COVID?
Well, I think for a lot of people when they were going through COVID and fertility treatments because they actually stopped doing a lot of fertility treatment procedures.
During that time.
Yes, because they had to redirect and refocus healthcare to, I suppose what they were saying, the people in higher need, you know, who were contracting COVID and then having multiple issues and going into hospital, and that's where the care was focused. So they shut down a lot of...
So it wasn't just you, it's a lot of people
had to stop.
Suffer, if you like, during that period.
Yeah, and be put on hold. And I think there were some, I can't remember if it was in Victoria only, or a lot of advocates really rose up and the government shifted their perspective because they were saying that it wasn't an urgent procedure. When in fact, you know, it is, because every month that goes by, especially if you're, you know,
it's a month they'll never get back.
It's a month that you don't get back, and they were putting everything on hold. And so some of our cycles didn't proceed as we had hoped. We couldn't go ahead with them, so our cycles were delayed as a result. You know, I don't think any of that changed the outcome, but yeah, you're right. COVID, I'm sure, gave a lot of people a lot of time to think about things and where they're at. And, you know, we transitioned from being so busy to then being perhaps not so busy. But then I think there's also a silver lining in that, like, you know, like the work from home, and and we can adapt and shift the way we actually live our lives. And I think COVID in many ways from that perspective probably allowed a lot of doors to open for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But for fertility, yeah, it was really hard being told that
you can't,
it had to all
anymore,
be put on hold. And every month is vital. So as soon as we were allowed in and got the paperwork, you know, I was on a plane going up to Brisbane for some, you know, scanning or some, you know, tests, and then I'd fly back, and then we would drive up together. And my son would come with me, and we'd go and live up there for a few weeks and do the cycles. But that's where I really saw, I suppose, the benefit to my mental health, which I think we still would have done even if we were here, was where you can actually have a positive experience during the cycle, even though it's really hard. And it's
rather
just
than staying at home, not not allowing yourself to go anywhere and try to make yourself more relaxed throughout that process.
Yes, try and find the moments of the joy in between all the chaos, which is really possible. And I think with Ivy Days, that's my main message, but it's not to diminish anybody's feelings, because it's really hard. It's such a hard process, but I want to come in from a different perspective and say it absolutely is, and it's very valid, everything you're feeling. But there are also other ways to help yourself and look at it slightly differently as well. And even if it's just as simple as date night, going and sitting at the park, watching the sunset together. And then if you need to take your medicine with you, well, I've provided the solution.
Right.
So it's trying to just be a more holistic around what are the areas in this process which is challenging that you can control, because the process of treatments, you can't control the outcome. And there's many businesses around nutrition and exercise and acupuncture and vitamins and supplements, but there wasn't anything in the space of what I have created. Well, I don't believe there to be, certainly not in Australia. And then that was my main thing, was to promote women's wellness, that they can have a more positive experience, but it requires, I suppose, a bit of a mental health shift and just realizing that their wellness is super important, and to encourage them to invoke that wellness while they're going through this process.
And give themselves permission to try to live a partially normal life, if you can, or whatever normal is when you're going through that.
Yes. One of my first customers, she bought the bag because she was cycling and she was going to a wedding. And it was so lovely to see the photo of her in a beautiful gown with the bag, and she was able to go and do her injections and be at the wedding. And, you know, that it just... it really warms my heart, because that's exactly why I made it. But it's not just for the weddings. It's if you need to go to work or if you need to travel. But the whole premise of it is just, here's a tool. This is my brand, and the bag that I've created is not going to guarantee you a baby, but it may well help you in that journey to just have a more comfortable experience. Mm. And there's elements of control that you can impart on your experience, but that's up to the individual. Yeah.
Yeah. We touched on before about the blog sitting dormant in your own little personal environment yeah. before you put it out into the world. And it touches on one of the other things that I found online, which was one of the very first videos that you did with regard to Ivy Days. And you recorded it, I believe it was in the July of 22, but didn't post it until December. And even in the comment you'd written, I've been too scared to post it, but I've realized that by not doing so, I'm only hurting myself. To be honest, obviously this conversation and the brand, everything's about Ivy Days, but I think this touches on everything, including myself. I'm curious about you sharing how you feel it's only hurting yourself. And also where that bit of courage come from in the end, and what triggered you to finally post it and go, no, I've got to share this.
Mm. I think that courage has to almost come every day, it's there some days and it's not other days.
Yeah.
I think sometimes when I record myself, it's a way of putting a stamp in time about how I'm feeling.
Mm.
And I will just talk, not with the expectation that, or even with my writing, not with the expectation that anybody will see it, but it's just to get those thoughts out of my brain. Because I recognize for myself that if I leave them in there, they that's not healthy for me.
Ferment.
Yeah. Or I go around in circles and it's just not the best practice for me. And I think, I don't know, maybe the trigger for that particular point in time was the fact of like, oh shit, I'm going to have to put myself out there. I'm planning to launch a brand, because at this point the brand wasn't launched, but I had just started dabbling in the social media spectrum. I think there's a couple of things. Absolutely, fear just rocks me to the core around what will people think of this, or I'm just adding noise. I'm not a medical professional. How dare I step into this space? There's all these things that say, no, I'm not good enough to put my content out there or create this business or to share tips or tricks or things that helped me, because I'm not a medical professional. And that comes in really strongly because I worked in the healthcare industry for so long that I feel like it's not my place to say that, or I might say the wrong thing. But I always know inherently deep down that when I'm not doing it, it's always because of fear. And I have to overcome that by doing the posting. So you need to take that step forward to overcome it, but that's the thing that's stopping you. But then you post it, and it might not even be the post, it could be something else in your life, and then you retrospectively look back and go, wow, that happened because I took an action on something that I was fearful of, and if I didn't, then maybe that wouldn't have happened.
Mm.
But it's constantly reminding myself about that. And I don't know what the trigger was in that particular time, other than the fact that my husband's probably saying to me, you know, you're going to have to start putting stuff out there. No one's going to know about your brand. And you are in many ways the brand, because it's your experience that has created it. Yep. And it's your story that's going to resonate with people. But I am very fearful that people will think, A, I'm taking advantage of a difficult situation, which it is not that at all, because I'm injecting myself right into it when I'm quite traumatized by my own experience. Yeah. This is very heartfelt business for me. Yeah. It's got a very special place, and it's just the root of me not doing things is always embedded and ingrained in fear. And I know the goodness is on the other side of that.
Yeah.
But I always have to push myself towards that. Yeah. I think that's with a lot of things in life, though, because you just don't know. I mean, I don't know if this business is going to be a success. Like, I have visions. I've got so much in my mind about what I want to create with this. And we've started small because that's all we could do for now. And I'm learning how to create a business in this space, in the e-commerce world. But it's always embedded in fear, but I always know that I've got to jump that hurdle to then get to the next place.
Yeah. And I think you said something about taken advantage or you said something.
Yeah, I get worried that I think I hold back slightly in overly promoting the brand because I do worry that.
It's a touchy subject.
Yeah, I worry that people will think that I'm trying to take advantage of people when they're vulnerable because it is a vulnerable component of their life, but it's a tool, it's a support.
That's right. It's something that is not there to take advantage of someone. It's actually something there to
help
and support. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting how we can flip that in our own little head, isn't it?
Like,
even though you've got something that's purely there to help and support, your mind's telling you, like, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
It's
And also, how dare I stay in this space because I have children I couldn't possibly understand. Yeah. That's what my head tells me.
Yeah.
I'm like, but actually I can because I went through it.
Yeah.
I had to inject myself. I had to have all the tests, been through it. Mm. But every single person's journey is unique and unique to them only.
Mm.
And I know it's bloody hard. And I know in my bones that these products and the things I have planned can and will help people.
Mm.
Like, and that's the driving force to keep going.
Mm.
But there are definitely some days where I retreat and I don't feel strong enough to really push myself in terms of getting the brand out there because I think, oh no, I don't know. I'm not sure. But I do. I am sure. I am really, really sure. But it's just, you know, the mind plays its tricks.
It does.
And I have to be strong enough and brave enough to just push to the next step. And everything good that's happened in the brand so far or in my own learnings with developing a brand has happened because I've been able to step over that fear and that hurdle. And the next thing wouldn't have happened if I didn't do that step. And then I try and remind myself that, but it's really hard. I suppose it's like anything, you know, you having your first baby, you don't know what's happening.
You try
and apply for a job or start a new job. You don't know.
Yeah.
You just do it.
And I think you're doing it with good intentions. So as long as you continue to do it with good intentions.
Exactly. And I really hope that is on display.
Yeah.
I hope as brand awareness happens and, you know, it's my sincere hope the brand does really, really well, that will always be evident in any of my communications .
And I think that brings me to the next question that is evident in the second video that there was there's these two videos that are on social media that stand out. The first was that you held back for a little bit before posting it. And the second one is the evidence of the emotion that's put into this is with your first sale, and the woman's name was Brittany, and it's an emotional video, though it's also a very inspirational video to know that that's what's gone into it. As you can see, you've put everything into creating Ivy Days. So what is one of the biggest lessons that you've learned along the way in creating Ivy Days to get to that first sale that made that so emotional?
Well, I think because I wasn't expecting a sale that day. We launched on the 9th of May this year, 2023. And a few months before the launch, if I can backdate it, I'm a perfectionist. I like to have everything perfect. And I was recognizing that was stopping me and holding me back. And so I knew I needed to set a date for launch because it was running wild. The product was ready. It was on its way, it was being produced, but we hadn't started advertising. So I decided to launch on the 9th of May 23 because on the 9th of May 22 I sold my previous business.
Yeah.
So and that was, you know, a bit bittersweet. So it was like, right, 9th of May, sold one, 9th of May the following year, started another one. So I set that date a few months ahead of that time, and then that was my go live date. So that was the day the website was going to launch, but we had no product imagery. It wasn't ready to be advertised yet. We only got some products photos taken the week or so before, so we had done no advertising. So there was no expectation of a sale. In my mind, it was about just get the website up and we'll try and build the brand from that. So when I, you know, I was sitting in front of the laptop and we'd launched it, and my husband was downstairs, you know, in the gym with some buddies, and I heard the cha-ching 20 minutes in, and we were late launching. We were supposed to do it at 9 o'clock, but we had a technical glitch, so it maybe went live at 20 past 9 or 9:30 that morning.
Yeah.
And I was sitting here just proud that it had been launched, and then to hear this cha-ching from Shopify pop up. And one of the pouches had been bought, and that video that you can't really hear the recording too well because I don't know what I'm doing on social media.
The music's quite loud. The background. The
music was too loud.
Yeah.
But I just got very emotional, and I thought, I'm just going to put the camera in front of my face and just start talking. And I did, and it was really emotional because the fact that it was so quickly from the website going live, I meant that you know, Brittany was sitting waiting, and that was really special in and of itself. It then validated to me someone wants the product.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I was really, really overwhelmed by it all. And Brittany and I ended up messaging her, and her and I had a phone call conversation the next day.
Yeah.
And I learned a little bit about her story and why she bought the pouch. And, you know, they weren't ready to start IVF. Yet they were a few months away, but she said, but I know I'm not going to be staying at home. I'd like to live my life. And when I saw this, I knew I had to have it. And the fact she hasn't even gone through IVF yet, but she was recognizing that in herself. And I said, this is exactly why I have made it. This is the whole reason this bag came into existence. And yeah, her, and she actually saw my video. And she was at work, and she's in healthcare as well.
Yeah.
And it meant even more from that someone who is providing healthcare purchased the bag. Also, that was also another special part for me because I've got healthcare experience. Yeah. And then
I think they'd see a lot, and it's for them to recognize that actually this is
something.
This is helpful. This is actually something that's going to help on my journey. Yeah.
Well, she said she was at work, and she started to cry watching the video, and no one knows about their need to use IVF and fertility treatment. And the receptionist had apparently said, are you okay? And she had to walk away. And then she went home and showed her husband. And so we shared, you know, a really lovely conversation with each other. And I've had similar conversations and connections with many of the women who have bought the bag, and it's gathering that feedback. What drew you to the bag? Why was it important for you to have this? Do you feel that there's a need? And then also asking them, is there anything else I can help you with? Is there any other products that you feel you might need in the space? And I'm creating really lovely connections with the majority of them, which is really nice. And just the fact that somebody else has recognized they need it and it will be helpful to them, that's all what it's about.
Yeah.
You know? And I had someone purchase on the weekend, and she forgot to pop express post in, and her cycle has already commenced. And, you know, I just said, don't worry about it, I will express post it to you. And she messaged me a couple of days ago with photos of the bag. And yeah, slowly but surely it's becoming known, very slowly, but I'm still learning in myself in building this business around advertising. And this is a whole new skill set to me. So I'm just giving myself permission to take my time with it, because this is just not another consumer brand. You know, this isn't something that someone's going to come in and they repeat buy, or, you know, there's a very special need for the, if they're buying, they're recognizing the need for them in themselves. And it's not going to be for everybody. Some people will say, I don't need that. I'll go to Kmart and buy an insulated bag and put an ice pack in, and that is perfectly okay. But every bag and every purchase that is made is just really special. I think I almost get tears every time at the minute. And, you know, it's very heartfelt, that's for sure. Yeah, and I've sent a few to America now. One's gone to New Zealand, and it's like people are seeing it. They're finding it, and I have to just continue to be brave enough to post about it and to share my story and to post about it on social media so that people can see it, and know it's here for them.
And then it's created from the Central Coast.
Yeah, it is.
It is. And like, to be honest, that's having like young kids on the Central Coast. And as I've shared, you like only been on the coast for 6 years, mm-hmm. and bringing kids up on the coast and getting involved in this sort of stuff, part of doing this podcast is to make my kids realize that one of the things we come to the coast was, oh, like, are they going to get the same opportunities they're going to have in Sydney or that sort of stuff? So it's always good, and this is why I like to highlight and interview people like yourself, is to highlight that it doesn't matter, that it's anything's possible even coming from the Central Coast, and that's what I want to instill in my children and anybody living here. So it's always good to hear, and that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So it's always good to see that postage from the Central Coast, from
yes.
Wombrel to yeah, the US.
South Carolina, yeah. I think my first right. US one went to. Yep.
Yeah, that's awesome. So as you mentioned, the product that you created and sold in that first video is the on-the-go pouch. I've looked at the video, and obviously I have no idea about IVF, but I can see it's constructed. There's a lot of thought gone into the design and everything for that pouch. What was the design process?
Yeah, well, many prototypes.
Yeah.
But I think for me, the main key thing was that it was around giving women something that was practical and supportive, but with anonymity, because not you know, if you're wanting to go on date night or go to dinner, go hang out with your girlfriends, go to the movies or whatever you want to do, but you might need to inject medication, you don't want people necessarily seeing all of that. So I knew that I wanted something that was convenient in a handbag-ish style design. So then that kind of gave me a guideline for, all right, well, what would the, you know, potential measurements be if it was a handbag design? But then it was all the internal elements of what type of medication might need to go in it and what size are those medications. So there was many prototypes around the internal structures of it, which features, you know, some straps and some Velcro areas and enclosed spaces and mesh areas so that people can put a variety of things like their antiseptic and antibacterial wipes, and then you have needle tips. And so I already had all my medications here, so I knew certain sizes of things, but there was definitely a design process around what all that looks like and where can it be placed. And really, I started off just with a pen and pencil around what I thought I would want, and then actually I ended up going into Smiggle and looking at Smiggle, you know, children's pencil cases, because they have the little Velcro, you know, pens and pencils go into it with little zips and compartments. And I took lots of imagery of those styles to try and get a feel for size. So that was one element of the design process, but it really was pen and paper, and then putting it into, we had connections with a manufacturer already. So showing them and telling them what I was hoping to achieve. I knew they had to have an element of insulation to keep the medicine cool. Some medications need to be kept cool, others don't. So it has the option where, you know, you might use the ice packs that are provided in the bag, or you might not need to. But the testing component of getting the insulation correct was quite challenging, because I wanted to make sure that it didn't get wet on the outside. So a lot of the prototypes had condensation as the ice packs were melting. So that was no good. So it was changing up the material and the type of material that was being used. One of the tests that we did, I have a temperature logger tester that tests every 3 minutes the temperature of wherever you put the logger. So I'm able to capture really good data in different environments around how the bag's performing. And one of the prototypes, it went to -5 degrees for 2 or 3 hours, which would freeze the medication. So I knew the internal structures had to shift, and went back to the manufacturer, and, you know, we worked on that for a little bit more. So lots of prototyping where they would make a bag with my information. They'd send it to me, I would test and then adapt from there. And, you know, we've finally gotten to a bag now that has no condensation on the outside. It stays cool, and it includes a sharps container inside of it. So that was a really important feature that I wanted to add, because everywhere I traveled, I had a really big, you know, 700 mil a liter sharps container, which was massive. So we were able to fit a travel sharps container in it, and you can use it hands-free. So like me, I was in the Gabba with filthy, dirty bathroom. There was nowhere I could hang my bag. So the strap can actually open, you know, you can lengthen the strap and open the bag 180 degrees. So you actually don't even have to put the bag down at all, and you can inject yourself cleanly and safely. Mm-hmm. And has an injection mat in it, which can be disinfected. So if you are in a situation where you don't have a clean surface, you can take the mat out and use that as a preparation area. And then that can be wiped down and disinfected and put that back in again. So it was really important to consider where would people use it and add those elements in to make sure that they have everything that they need to really, I've called it the on-the-go pouch, because it really just keeps being that statement. I want them to be able to inject and carry their medicine safely on the go.
Yeah.
You know, if you're at home, you probably have things in your fridge, or you have a different, you know, setup. We do have a fridge caddy to help people maintain their medication in a dedicated area and discreet area.
Yeah.
Because even putting medication in your fridge, you can put it in the wrong area, and that has a potential consequence of your medications as well. And another reason for starting the business is one of my cycles, my medications did in fact heat up too much. Mm. And that cycle did not go very, very well. And the doctor believed it was because my medication heated up. And that was probably one of our most traumatic cycles. So those two elements of A, the meds heating up on one cycle, and then injecting in the filthy female public toilets in Brisbane, were the combining forces to create the pouch. The brand itself is around keeping well during fertility treatments and encouraging people to live as normal a life during it, and it is absolutely possible, and here's some support tools that might help you do that. Yeah,
I think you're talking about the fridge. I think I've even seen a video of you describing like putting the fridge in different spots in the fridge.
And yes.
Yeah. Lastly, what message or piece of advice would you like to share with women or couples currently beginning or even already on their fertility journey?
Yeah, I think what I would say is there's a combination of things. I really, really believe your wellness is so important during fertility treatments, and it's a really challenging, difficult journey. And I think there are really good benefits to trying to find moments of joy in amongst it all, and not being in the, you know, pits of despair through the whole process. It is possible to have good moments and you'll have awful moments, but it is you are able to experience your fertility treatment slightly differently if you explore those options, and I think that's really important. I think counseling is another aspect that's really, really helpful, together with your partner or on your own, and that everybody that's involved in a partnership has that opportunity to do that. And then communication as well, because I know that, you know, I closed my husband out for the first cycle, and then when it actually, the whole experience has made us stronger as a couple, but it equally could have gone the other way, and I think that would have all come down to lack of communication. So I think that's a really important aspect of it for your own sanity and just for the benefit of your relationship. And I also think perhaps you might need to take breaks every now and then and realize that you don't have to go cycle after cycle, and really sit with your feelings and see how you're feeling about everything as you're moving through it, but maybe in between cycles as well. And another piece of advice I would say is if you're feeling not comfortable with your clinic, to get a second opinion. That's an option. We took that option, and I know many people do that, and I think that's also really important, because no one really knows exactly what your body is going to do, and no one can guarantee anything in this process. But I do believe asking for other opinions can be really, really valuable. And then one last piece of advice is tell people how they can help you. And then you and I were speaking a little bit before we started recording, is that I feel like it's sometimes up to us as the people going through the experience to tell other people how can they best support us, because we had expectations, I suppose. You don't even realize it at the time, but we had expectations around how people might treat us or ask us about our journey or see how we were going or checking in. And people get too scared to ask because they feel like it's a hard conversation or that you might not want to speak about it. And you might not want to speak about it, and that's perfectly okay. But I do feel there's a responsibility on us going through the treatments to let people know how they can best support us, because I think most people, your loved ones around you probably want to support you, but sometimes they're unsure. And then we almost expect sometimes that they will know how to support us, and then there's a disconnect there. And then I think that can add to what's already happening in the situation of fertility treatments and experiencing infertility. But I think it's we can all help each other, you know. And so I believe, yeah, we can tell people what it is that we need. And if that means, no, I don't want to talk about it, then you let people know that you don't want to talk about it. But if you do want to talk about it, let people know that you're open to talking about it and go from there. But, yeah, my main thing is especially directed at women, just really care for yourself and love yourself and know that it's not your fault, your body's not failing you, and you're doing just the best that you can with what the situation is, and love yourself, you know, and love your relationship and try and protect that. And just do the best with what you can at that moment, you know, and you can change your mind, you know, change your mind if you need
to. That's right. Yeah.
You know, exactly. The decisions you make today aren't necessarily tomorrow either. You can, just be kind to yourself. Yeah.
Well, Tanya, thank you for sharing and sitting down and talking to me about IVF and your business and all of that, and being so open with me, at the end of the day. I've read your blog, I've read a fair bit about you before coming here, but I just want to show my gratitude for being so open and sitting down and having this conversation with me, a stranger, about something that's so personal. So thank you
for the opportunity,
and also thank you for what you're doing to help other women and that throughout this journey, fertility. If anyone would like to know and find out more about Tanya and Ivy Days, you can go to ivydays.au or simply search Ivy Days online, Ivy Days with a Z. Thank you, Tanya.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. Thanks, Luke.
Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the Central Coast of New South Wales.